Selected Shorts is supported in part by the loyal friends of Selected Shorts. To join, or for more information, visit selectedshorts.org.
It had been his idea, not hers, to take a run at the door after nothing else worked. When it burst open, they had found themselves face to face with each other. They had both felt it, the sense of something unexpected stirring up, rising right through them. It was just a matter of surrendering to it.
This week on Selected Shorts, a woman of mystery and an incredible expanding apartment.
Sutiline opened his eyes at once. In an instant, he was sitting up, looking dazedly around the room. The table that usually stood right there at the head of the bed had moved off into the middle of a faintly familiar, large but ungainly room.
This is Selected Shorts from PRI. You'll hear great short fiction from authors you know and some you might want to get to know, read live by some great actors on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. On this program, we'll hear stories about people often very near and sometimes not so dear to us, the neighbors. We begin with a story by James Lasdun, who was born in a big city, London, but now lives in upstate New York. A Woman at the Window could be considered a cautionary tale for you guys who want to rescue damsels in distress. Our reader is a star of the Thalia Follies political cabaret at Symphony Space, Lenya Rideout.
A young Englishman was walking down a street in the West Village. He'd come to New York on an internship at the Manhattan branch of the auction house he worked for in London, and he was on his way to appraise a painting at the home of a private collector. He was early for his appointment, and he moved along at a leisurely pace, gazing appreciatively into the boutiques lining the street. He liked New York. Superior versions of all the things he enjoyed most in life: clothes, cocktails, art books, restaurant meals were available everywhere at half the price they cost in London. And wherever he went, people seemed smitten by his unusually pure Englishness, his drawl, his unfailingly polite manner, his pallid good looks. He had a girlfriend in London who worked for a merchant bank. Every morning he spoke to her on the phone, and every night he sent her an email, usually with some anecdote chosen to appeal to her sense of the ridiculous. The beggar he had given a handful of change to, only to be indignantly informed by the man that he didn't accept no goddamn pennies. The clam bake he had gone to on the beach in East Hampton wearing shorts and a t-shirt, where it turned out all the other men were wearing linen suits and ties. And this, too, the gathering up of all these little stories to share with his girlfriend, was a part of his enjoyment of the city. He turned onto a quieter street of brick townhouses with window boxes and small front gardens enclosed in iron railings. About halfway along, he heard a voice shouting from above him, "Sir, sir, excuse me, sir." He looked up. A woman was leaning out of a window on the top floor. "Could you help me, please? I broke the handle on my door and I can't get out of my apartment." He hesitated, not sure how to respond. "I feel like such an idiot, but I don't know what to do. I'm trapped in here." "Do you think maybe you could open the door from the outside if I buzz you in?" She spoke slowly, in a high, rather plaintive voice. Her brown hair gleamed in the sun. She wore a pale turtleneck sweater. "Well, all right. Thank you. I'm in 4A. There's no elevator. Sorry." The door buzzed, and he stepped into a dim hallway with cracked marble tiles and a row of brass mailboxes. As he climbed the wooden stairs, it occurred to him that he was being set up to be mugged. This was no doubt some old trick, well known to New Yorkers, but still good for a newcomer like himself. The woman had probably spotted him the moment he'd turned down the street. Guessed he was English, from the herringbone jacket, perhaps, or the old-fashioned brogues that he had polished that morning, and readied her accomplice, some thug who would be waiting for him behind the door with a knife or a gun. He should go back outside immediately, he told himself, turn around and leave. But something, some perverse pride or gallantry prevented him. He moved on, up the stairs, not afraid, but with a feeling of melancholy reservation. The door to foyer was a dull beige color with an egg-shaped brass knob. He knocked. There was a movement at the peephole, then the woman's voice, softer now. Hi. What shall I do? I guess try turning the handle? He turned the handle, but it didn't seem to be connected to anything. I think the spindle may have come out. Oh, well, try just pushing. He gave the door a push. Nothing much seems to be happening. Push harder. He pushed as hard as he could. Still, the door didn't budge. I think you may need to take a run at it, the woman said. He paused. The imagined mugging gave way in his mind to a more sinister scenario. He was going to be accused of breaking and entering, or whatever they called it here, caught on some hidden camera, perhaps. Blackmailed. Thoughts of some embarrassing drama involving the police and his supervisors at work went through him, and yet, the same fatalistic resignation as before. He stepped back along the landing and ran full tilt at the door, hurling himself against it. This time, it burst open. He and the woman stood face to face. She looked about 40, her features lined but still youthful, a narrow charcoal skirt hanging below her close-fitting sweater. There appeared to be no one else in the apartment, a studio by the looks of it, with bare brick walls, shelves full of magazines and plants, and a bed in the far corner, half hidden by a screen. After a moment of startled silence, the woman spoke. Wow. You did it. So it would appear. That's wonderful. I don't know what I would have done. I was just trying to go out. Well, I'm glad to have helped. She had been smiling, but now she began to look agitated, her eyes darting around the room as if seeking support from familiar objects. The situation, though evidently not dangerous, seemed to him freshly awkward. It struck him that having forced the door open, he had taken on the aspect of an intruder, even though the woman had asked him to do it. For a moment, this made him actually feel like an intruder, stirring something unexpected inside him. And this, in turn, prompted the thought that he must leave immediately so as not to appear to be trying to take advantage in some underhand way. He straightened his jacket. The woman glanced at him, smiling nervously. I don't know how to thank you. Oh, no need. Can I offer you a cup of coffee? No, that's very kind of you. A drink? He laughed. A little early for me. Oh, well, goodbye then. Goodbye. He went back down the stairs, smiling to himself. Already, as he reached the street, he was composing in his mind the email he would send to his girlfriend that night. He would make the whole story into a little mock epic of suspense and misplaced apprehension, with the woman as a damsel in distress and himself as the naive but gallant knight, too chivalrous to ignore her plea for help. He would describe the gloomy hallway, the sense of being led into a trap, the melancholy obligation to proceed nevertheless, the oddness of breaking into a strange woman's flat. His little moment of male regression he would omit, but he would try to describe the woman herself. Although, what was there to be said about her after all? A New York woman of a certain well-groomed type, more glamorous looking than her English counterpart, her face more concertedly made up, her hair more showily coiffured, her manner at once more direct and more remote, giving that odd effect of intimacy and unknowability. He pictured her again, facing him in the doorway with her dazed, slightly frantic expression, the afternoon light refracting on the surface of her hair. Her voice came back to him, high and a little mournful. "I was just trying to go out." Briefly, a vague disquiet entered him as though there had been some complication present in the picture that he had failed to grasp at the time. He tried to pin it down, but it seemed to retreat from him as he pursued it. And by the time he arrived at his destination on Washington Street, he had decided he was mistaken. It was as he had thought. The woman herself had been the least interesting aspect of the whole situation. She went straight to the kitchenette and poured a vodka martini into one of the cocktail glasses chilling on the shelf of the freezer. Listening to his shoes stomp down the last flight of stairs, she swept the chrysanthemum stems into the disposal unit and stepped over to the window where she watched him come out through the door and walk off down the block. God damn Englishman. The accent had thrown her, triggering some absurd reflex of guilty nervousness. That and how much younger he was than she'd thought. The sun sank down behind the rooftop opposite and the color drained out of the room. Only the chrysanthemums, still glowing yellow on the coffee table, as if they'd been dipped in some kind of luminous paint. A mistake, those. The wrong note entirely. She must have realized that unconsciously. She'd picked them up on impulse, coming back from the liquor store with the stoli, and then forgotten about them till he was already in the building, so that she had had to unwrap them and trim them and set them in their vase, all in the space it took him to climb the stairs, forgetting even then to throw out the stems, which meant that the entire time he was there, she'd had to be thinking about whether he had noticed them, and if so, whether it was reasonable or paranoid to imagine he might infer from them that she was not, in fact, just going out, but had just come in which case... Ah, who cares? She said, tipping back the rest of her drink. She stood, consulting her own restlessness. After a few minutes, a smile rose onto her face. Was this what was going to happen? There were ways in which the world forced itself on you, and you had no choice but to yield. But there were also ways of using your own weakness as a source of strength. In high school, she and her best friend had discovered that they could do anything the other dared them to by telling themselves that they would do it on the count of three, with eternal damnation as the penalty for chickening out. 1, 2, 3, and without hesitation, the highway at the end of the school road would be crossed, blindfolded, the cherry bomb-rigged toy boat sent floating over the pond to explode amid the boys' fleet of miniature clippers, the mystery substance puffed, sniffed, swallowed. Cumulative observances had strengthened the rite over time until it came to possess an almost magical potency with no need of the penalty clause to enforce it. She had continued to practice it in college and on into adult life, using it not just for feats of gratuitous recklessness, but also for simple practical purposes. One, two, three, and she could dive into the icy lake her husband's family had owned in Maine. One, two, three, and she could make her call up her brother in his law office in Atlanta and ask for a loan. It wasn't about willpower. It was about submission. That was the glory of it. She strode over the table and picked up the bowl of flowers, carried them into the kitchenette, and shoved them into the garbage. No more innovations. From the kitchenette, she went over to the door and wedged the thick brass tongue all but a few millimeters in, using a paperclip the way she had figured out earlier that summer. And then, pushing the door till she heard the little click, she crossed the room to take up her position once again beside the quartered glass of casement window. The sky was clear, just a small fleet of clouds patrolling the river, pink lit from beneath. Nobody of any interest on the street. She waited, thinking of the first time it had happened. She really had locked herself in, pulled the handle and its mechanism right out of the door, and then been unable to unfasten the catch. In a panic of claustrophobia, she had called down to the first person she'd seen passing, a man in a business suit who turned out to be a shoe retailer on his way back to check out a new storefront. It had been his idea, not hers, to take a run at the door after nothing else worked. When it burst open, they had found themselves face to face with each other. They had both felt it, the sense of something unexpected stirring up, rising right through them. It was just a matter of surrendering to it. He had stood there with a confused look on his face, making no attempt either to leave or to come farther in. She'd offered him coffee. Then, before she'd been able to form an answer, had heard herself add a drink, at which he had smiled very sweetly. She smiled back now, remembering. A man appeared, coming east along the block from Greenwich Street. She studied him carefully as he approached. He was tall, lean, with long, graying hair, leather coat, jeans, scuffed cowboy boots, a little wolfish maybe, his chin unshaven by the look of it. But after Mr. Tweed Jacket, that was maybe just what she needed. She gripped the handles on the window and slid it up. For a moment, a feeling of vertigo passed through her as if she had opened the window onto a bottomless void. One, two, three, she counted in silence, then heard her own voice calling, "Sir, sir, excuse me, sir."
Lena Rideout was the beguiling woman in James Lasdon's The Woman at the Window. We turn now to a story about a man with a shape-shifting apartment. It's by the Ukrainian-born Sigismund Krzyżanowski, who died in 1950. Krzyżanowski created philosophical, satirical, and fantastical tales that ignored the Soviet government mandate to portray the state in a positive light. And for this, he remained unpublished for decades. This story about the changing, evolving dimensions of its hero's living space and of his mind is called Quadraturin. The reader, David Rakoff, has just published a new book entitled Half Empty.
From outside, there came a soft knock at the door. Once, pause. And again, a bit louder and bonier, twice. Sutulin, without rising from his bed, extended, as was his wont, a foot toward the knock, threaded a toe through the door handle, and pulled. The door swung open. On the threshold, head grazing the lintel, stood a tall gray man, the color of the dusk seeping in at the window. Before Soutouline could set his feet on the floor, the visitor stepped inside, wedged the door quietly back into its frame, and jabbing first one wall, then another, with a briefcase dangling from an apishly long arm, said, "Yes, a matchbox." "What?" "Your room," I say. "It's a matchbox. How many square feet?" 86 and a bit. "Precisely. May I?" And before Soutouline could open his mouth, the visitor sat down on the edge of the bed and hurriedly unbuckled his bulging briefcase. Lowering his voice almost to a whisper, he went on, "I'm here on business. You see, we are conducting, how shall I put it, well, experiments, I suppose. Under wraps for now. I won't hide the fact a well-known foreign firm has an interest in our concern. You want the electric light switch? No, don't bother. I'll only be a minute. So then, we have discovered, this is a secret now, an agent for biggerizing rooms." "Well, won't you try it?" The stranger's hand popped out of the briefcase and proffered Soutouline a narrow, dark tube, not unlike a tube of paint, with a tightly screwed cap and a leaden seal. Soutouline fidgeted bewilderedly with the slippery tube, and though it was nearly dark in the room, made out the label, the clearly printed word, "Quadraturin." When he raised his eyes, they came up against the fixed, unblinking stare of his interlocutor. "So, then, you'll take it? The price? Goodness, it's gratis. Just for advertising. Now, if you will," the guest began quickly leafing through a sort of ledger he had produced from the same briefcase. "Just sign this book, a short testimonial, so to say. A pencil? Have mine. Where? Here, column 3. That's it." His ledger clapped shut. The guest straightened up, wheeled round, stepped to the door, and a minute later, Soutouline, having snapped on the light, was considering with puzzledly raised eyebrows the clearly embossed letters, "Quadraturin." On closer inspection, turned out that this zinc packet was tightly fitted, as is often done by the makers of patented agents, with a thin transparent wrapper whose ends were expertly glued together. Soutouline removed the paper sheath from the Quadraturin, unfurled the rolled-up text, which showed through the paper's transparent gloss, and read, "Directions. Dissolve 1 teaspoon of the Quadraturin essence in 1 cup of water. Wet a piece of cotton wool, or simply a clean rag, with the solution. Apply this to those of the room's internal walls designated for proliferspansion. This mixture leaves no stains, will not damage wallpaper, and even contributes incidentally to the extermination of bedbugs." Thus far, Soutouline had only been puzzled. Now his puzzlement was gradually overtaken by another feeling, strong and disturbing. He stood up and tried to pace from corner to corner, but the corners of this living cage were too close together. A walk amounted to almost nothing but turns, from toe to heel and back again. Soutouline stopped short, sat down, and closing his eyes, gave himself up to thoughts which began, "Why not? What if, suppose," to his left, not 3 feet away from his ear, someone was driving an iron spike into the wall. The hammer kept slipping, banging, and aiming, it seemed, at Soutouline's head. Rubbing his temples, he opened his eyes. The black tube lay in the middle of the narrow table, which had managed somehow to insinuate itself between the bed, the windowsill, and the wall. Soutouline tore away the leaden seal, and the cap spun off in a spiral. From out of the round aperture came a bitterish, gingery smell. The smell made his nostrils flare pleasantly. Let's try it, although... And, having removed his jacket, the possessor of Quadraturin proceeded to the experiment. Stool up against the door, bed into the middle of the room, table on top of bed. nudging across the floor a saucer of transparent liquid, its glassy surface gleaming with a slightly yellowish tinge. Soutoline crawled along after it, systematically dipping a handkerchief wound round a pencil into the quadraturine and daubing the floorboards and patterned wallpaper. The room really was, as that man today had said, a matchbox. But Soutoline worked slowly and carefully, trying not to miss a single corner. This was rather difficult, since the liquid really did evaporate in an instant, or was absorbed, he couldn't tell which, without leaving even the slightest film. There was only its smell, increasingly pungent and spicy, making his head spin, confounding his fingers, and causing his knees pinned to the floor to tremble slightly. When he had finished with the floorboards and the bottom of the walls, Soutoline rose to his strangely weak and heavy feet and continued to work, standing up. Now and then he had to add a little more of the essence. The tube was gradually emptying. It was already night outside. In the kitchen to the right, a bolt came crashing down. The apartment was readying for bed. Trying not to make any noise, the experimenter, clutching the last of the essence, climbed up onto the bed and from the bed up onto the tottering table. Only the ceiling remained to be quadraturinized. But then someone banged on the wall with his fist. "What's going on? People are trying to sleep. Are these..." Turning round at the sound, Soutoline fumbled. The slippery tube spurted out of his hand and landed on the floor. Balancing carefully, Soutoline got down with his already drying brush, but it was too late. The tube was empty, and the rapidly fading spot around it smelled stupefyingly sweet. Grasping at the wall in his exhaustion, two fresh sounds of discontent from the left, he summoned his last bit of strength, put the furniture back where it was, and without undressing, fell into bed. A black sleep instantly descended upon him from above. Both tube and man were empty. Two voices began in a whisper, then by degrees of sonority, from piano to mezzo forte, from mezzo forte to fortissimo, they cut into Soutoline's sleep. "Outrageous! I don't want any new tenants popping out from under that skirt of yours. Put up with all of that racket? Well, I can't just dump it into the garbage. I don't want to hear about it. You were told, no dogs, no cats, no children," at which point there ensued such fortissimo that Soutoline was ripped once and for all from his sleep. Unable to part eyelids stitched together with exhaustion, he reached, as was his wont, for the edge of the table on which stood the clock. Then it began. His hand groped for a long time, grappling air. There was no clock and no table. Soutoline opened his eyes at once. In an instant, he was sitting up, looking dazedly around the room. The table that usually stood right there at the head of the bed had moved off into the middle of a faintly familiar, large but ungainly room. Everything was the same, the skimpy, threadbare rug that had trailed after the table somewhere up ahead of him, and the photographs and the stool and the yellow patterns on the wallpaper, but they were all strangely spread out inside the expanded room cube. "Quadraturine," thought Soutoline, "is terrific." And he immediately set about rearranging the furniture to fit the new space. But nothing worked. The abbreviated rug, when moved back beside the bed, exposed worn, bare floorboards. The table and the stool, pushed by habit against the head of the bed, had disencumbered an empty corner latticed with cobwebs and littered with shreds and tatters, once artfully masked by the corner's own crowdedness and the shadow from the table. With a triumphant but slightly frightened smile, Soutoline went all around his new practically squared square, scrutinizing every detail. He noted with displeasure that the room had grown more in some places than in others. An external corner, the angle of which was now obtuse, had made the wall askew. Quadraturine apparently did not work as well on internal corners. Carefully as Soutoline had applied the essence, the experiment had produced somewhat uneven results. The apartment was beginning to stir. Out in the corridor, occupants shuffled to and fro. The bathroom door kept banging. Suteline walked up to the threshold and turned the key to the right. Then, hands clasped behind his back, he tried pacing from corner to corner. It worked. Suteline laughed with joy. How about that? At last! But then he thought, they may hear my footsteps through the walls on the right, on the left, at the back. For a minute he stood stock still. Then he quickly bent down. His temples had suddenly begun to ache with yesterday's sharp, thin pain. And having removed his boots, gave himself up to the pleasure of a stroll, moving soundlessly about in only his socks. May I come in? The voice of the landlady. He was on the point of going to the door and unlocking it when he suddenly remembered he mustn't. I'm getting dressed. Wait a minute, I'll be right out. It's all very well, but it complicates things. Say, I lock the door and I take the key with me, but what about the keyhole? And then there's the windows. I'll have to get curtains today. The pain in his temples had become thinner and more nagging. Suteline gathered up his papers in haste. It was time to go to the office. He dressed, pushed the pain under his cap, and listened at the door. No one there. He quickly opened it, quickly slipped out, quickly turned the key. Now. Waiting patiently in the entrance hall was the landlady. I wanted to talk to you about that girl. What's her name? Can you believe it? She submitted an application to the housing committee saying she's... I've heard. Go on. It's nothing to you. No one's going to take your 86 square feet away. But put yourself in my shoes. I'm in a hurry. He nodded his cap and flew down the stairs. On his way home from the office, Suteline paused in front of the window of a furniture dealer. The long curve of a couch, a round extendable table. It would be nice. But how could he carry them in past the eyes and the questions? They would guess. They couldn't help but guess. He had to limit himself to the purchase of a yard of canary yellow material. He did, after all, need a curtain. He didn't stop by the cafe. He had no appetite. He needed to get home. It would be easier there. He could reflect, look around, and make adjustments at leisure. Having unlocked the door to his room, Suteline gazed about to see if anyone was looking. They weren't. He walked in. Then he switched on the light and stood there for a long time, his arms spread flat against the wall, his heart beating wildly. This he had not expected. Not at all. The quadraturine was still working. During the 8 or 9 hours Suteline had been out, it had pushed the walls at least another 7 feet apart. The floorboards, stretched by invisible rods, rang out at his first step like organ pipes. The entire room, distended and monstrously misshapen, was beginning to frighten and torment him. Without taking off his coat, Suteline sat down on the stool and surveyed his spacious and at the same time oppressive coffin-shaped living box, trying to understand what had caused this unexpected effect. Then he remembered. He hadn't done the ceiling. The essence had run out. His living box was spreading only sideways, without rising even an inch upwards. Stop. I have to stop this quadraturinizing thing, or I'll... He pressed his palms to his temples and listened. The corrosive pain lodged under his skull since morning was still drilling away. Though the windows in the house opposite were dark, Suteline took cover behind the yellow length of curtain. His head would not stop aching. He quickly undressed, snapped out the light, and got into bed. At first he slept, then he was awoken by the feeling of awkwardness. Wrapping the covers more tightly about him, Suteline again dropped off, and once more an unpleasant sense of mooringlessness interfered with his sleep. He raised himself up on one palm and felt all around him with his free hand. The wall was gone. He struck a match. He blew out the flame and hugged his knees till his elbows cracked. It's growing, damn, it's still growing. Clenching his teeth, Sutaline crawled out of bed and, trying not to make any noise, gently edged first the front legs and then the back legs of the bed toward the receding wall. He felt a little shivery. Without turning the light on again, he went to look for his coat on that nail in the corner so as to wrap himself up more warmly. But there was no hook on the wall where it had been yesterday, and he had to feel around for several seconds before his hands chanced upon fur. Twice more during a night that was long and nagging as the pain in his temples, Sutaline pressed his head and knees to the wall as he was falling asleep, and when he awoke, fiddled about with the legs of the bed again. In doing this mechanically, meekly, lifelessly, he tried, though it was still dark outside, not to open his eyes. It was better that way. Toward dusk the next evening, having served out his day, Sutaline was approaching the door to his room. He did not quicken his step, and upon entering felt neither consternation nor horror. When the dim 16-candle power bulb lit up somewhere in the distance, beneath the long, low vault, its yellow rays struggling to reach the dark, ever-receding corners of the vast and dead yet empty barrack, which only recently before Quadraturini had been a cramped but cozy, warm, and lived-in cubbyhole, he walked resignedly toward the yellow square of the window, now diminished by perspective. He tried to count his steps. From there, from a bed squeezed pitifully and fearfully in the corner by the window, he stared dully and wearily through deep, boring pain at the swaying shadows nestled against the floorboards and at the smooth, low overhang of the ceiling. So something forces its way out of a tube and can't stop squaring, a square squared, a square of squares squared. I've got to think faster than it. If I don't outthink it, it will outgrow me. And suddenly someone was hammering on the door. Citizen Sutaline, are you in there? From the same faraway place came the muffled and barely audible voice of the landlady. He's in there, he must be asleep. Sutaline broke into a sweat. What if I don't get there in time? And they go ahead and, trying not to make a sound, let them think he was asleep. He slowly made his way through the darkness to the door. There. Who is it? Oh, open up. Why is the door locked? Remeasuring commission. We'll remeasure and leave. Sutaline stood with his ear pressed to the door. Through the thin panel, he could hear the clump of heavy boots. Figures were being mentioned and room numbers. This room next. Open up. With one hand, Sutaline gripped the knob of the electric light switch and tried to twist it as one might twist the head of a bird. The switch spattered light, then crackled, spun feebly around, and drooped again. Again, someone hammered on the door. Well? Sutaline turned the key to the left. A broad black shape squeezed itself into the doorway. Turn on the light. It's burned out. Clutching at the door handle with his left hand and the bundle of wire with his right, he tried to hide the extended space from view. The black mass took a step back. Who's got a match? Give me that box. We'll have a look anyway. Do things right. Suddenly, the landlady began whining. Oh, what is that to look at? 86 square feet for the 86th time. Measuring the room won't make it any bigger. He's a quiet man, home from a long day at the office, and you won't let him rest, have to measure and remeasure, whereas other people who have no right to the space. But still, ain't that the truth? The black mass muttered, and rocking from boot to boot, gently and even almost affectionately, drew the door to the light. Sutaline was left alone on wobbling, cottony legs in the middle of the four-cornered, inexorably growing and proliferating darkness. He waited until their steps had died away, then quickly dressed and went out. They'd be back to remeasure or check they hadn't undermeasured or whatever. He could finish thinking better here from crossroad to crossroad. Toward night, a wind came up. It rattled the bare frozen branches on the trees, shook the shadows loose, droned in the wires, and beat against walls as if trying to knock them down. Hiding the needle-like pain in his temples from the wind's buffets, Suthuline went on, now diving into the shadows, now plunging into the lamplight. Suddenly, through the wind's rough thrusts, something softly and tenderly brushed against his elbow. He turned round. Beneath feathers batting against a black brim, a familiar face with provocatively half-closed eyes, and barely audible through the moaning air, you know me, and you look right past me, you ought to bow. That's it. Her slight figure, tossed back by the wind, perched on tenacious stiletto heels, was all insubordination and readiness for battle. Suthuline tipped his hat. But you were supposed to be going away, and you're still here. Then something must have prevented. That's right. This. And he felt a chamois finger touch his chest and then dart back into the muff. He sought out the narrow pupils of her eyes beneath the dancing black feathers, and it seemed that one more look, one more touch, one more shock to his hot temples, and it would all come unthought, undone, and fall away. Meanwhile, she, her face nearing his, said, "Let's go to your place. Like last time, remember?" With that, everything stopped. "That's impossible." She sought out the arm that had been pulled back and clung to it with tenacious chamois fingers. "My place isn't fit." He looked away, having again withdrawn both his arms and the pupils of his eyes. "You mean to say it's cramped? My God, how silly you are. The more cramped it is," the wind tore away the end of her phrase. Suthuline did not reply. "Or perhaps you don't." When he reached the turning, he looked back. The woman was still standing there, pressing her muff to her bosom like a shield. Her narrow shoulders were shivering with cold. The wind cynically flicked her skirt and lifted up the lappets of her coat. "Tomorrow, everything tomorrow, but now," and quickening his pace, Suthuline turned resolutely back. "Right now, while everyone's asleep, collect my things, only the necessaries, and go. Leave the door wide open. Let them. Why should I be the only one? Why not let them?" The apartment was indeed sleepy and dark. Suthuline walked down the corridor, straight and to the right, opened the door with resolve, and, as always, wanted to turn the light switch, but it spun feebly in his fingers, reminding him that the circuit had been broken. This was an annoying obstacle, but it couldn't be helped. Suthuline rummaged in his pockets and found a box of matches. It was almost empty. Good for 3 or 4 flares, that's all. He would have to husband both light and time. When he reached the coat pegs, he struck the first match. Light crept in yellow radiuses through the black air. Suthuline, purposely overcoming temptation, concentrated on the illuminated scrap of wall and the coats and jackets hanging from hooks. He knew that there, behind his back, the dead, quadraturinized space with its black corners was still spreading. He knew and did not look round. The match smoldered in his left hand. His right pulled things off hooks and flung them on the floor. He needed another flare. Looking at the floor, he started toward the corner, if it was still a corner and if it was still there, where, by his calculations, the bed should have fetched up. But he accidentally held the flame under his breath, and again the black wilderness closed in. One last match remained. He struck it over and over. It would not light. One more time, and its crackling head fell off and slipped through his fingers. Then, having turned around, afraid to go any further into the depths, the man started back toward the bundle he had abandoned under the hooks. But he had made the turn apparently inexactly. He walked heel to toe, holding his fingers out in front of him, and found nothing. Neither the bundle nor the hooks, not even the walls. "I'll get there in the end. I must get there." His body was sticky with cold and sweat. His legs wobbled oddly. The man squatted down, palms on the floorboards. I shouldn't have come back. Now here I am alone, nowhere to turn. And suddenly it struck him. I'm waiting here, but it's growing. I'm waiting, and it's... In their sleep and in their fear, the occupants of the quadratures adjacent to Citizen Soutouline's 86 square feet couldn't make head or tail of the timbre and intonation of the cry that woke them in the middle of the night and compelled them to rush to the threshold of the Soutouline cell. For a man who is lost and dying in the wilderness to cry out is both futile and belated. But if even so, against all sense, he does cry out, then most likely thus.
That was David Rakoff being pushed to the edge of sanity in Sigismund Krzyżanowski's story Quadraturen. After a brief break, we'll hear this year's Selected Shorts contest-winning story and some words of wisdom from yours truly about apartment house elevators. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Calling all writers in our audience, announcing the 2011 Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Prize. This year's theme is stories set in restaurants and bars. The judge is the author Jennifer Egan, and the deadline is March 1st, 2011. All the details can be found at selectedshorts.org. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. For more information about the stories or readers, go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. The two stories we've just heard were performed at a Selected Shorts evening called Apartments and Neighbors, during which I offered our live audience members a few words of advice which you who live in cities may find useful.
I want to tell you, friends, that after decades of living in a Manhattan apartment building and riding in its elevator, it's my pleasure for the betterment of civic life in our neighborhood to offer you a following list of elevator do's and don'ts. Number one, do not make inane elevator conversation. This is an unfortunate practice prompted by the residents' fear of silence. Resist it. There is nothing wrong with silence, even if it lasts from the first floor all the way up to the 32nd floor penthouse, especially as compared to such gnomic utterances as, "Someday, isn't it?" or, "Wow, those Mets are something else." A lady in my building would say to me in the elevator for years the following, "Well, we asked for it." I never had a clue as to what she was referring to. What had we asked for? Medicare? Christmas? Probably she meant the weather, you know, cooler, warmer. I never knew what to say as her inquiring gaze pierced me. I usually murmured, "Oh, we sure did," hating myself for giving in. So my advice to you is keep silent. Number two, if you feel you must hum on long or short elevator rides, hum to yourself, silently. Three, it's a long and hallowed tradition, probably altogether unknown to you younger audience members, that gentlemen should remove their hats if there are ladies present in the elevator. This is now outdated and absurd, and Mayor Bloomberg promises to repeal this as part of the many significant accomplishments of his third term. Number four, when coming home after walking your dog in the rain, encourage Fido to do that thing where he shakes off all the water before entering the elevator. And talking of dogs, if a neighbor's dog in the elevator begins to sniff your private parts, male or female, do not cry out in protest or anger at the dog's owner. Doing so can make for long-lived animosities among building residents. The correct thing to do, though some of you may not immediately agree with this, is to stand very still and pretend it's not happening. Even as the dog's excitement mounts. Yes, I said mounts. This may take great self-control, but it will pay off in less acrimony at the co-op board meetings. If necessary, at such moments, you may hum, but silently. Finally, it is okay to ask someone nearer than you to the elevator buttons to press 6 for me, please. When you are asked to do this, you may not refuse. But do not say, 6? Is that where you live? I had you confused with the couple on 8. If you enter the elevator first and are right by the buttons, do not cry out, numbers, please. That sort of thing is okay in department stores, but not in fine residences where we are trying to maintain property values. Act accordingly. Thank you.
Now, on to our final story. Each year, Selected Shorts conducts the Stella Kupferberg Short Story Prize Contest, which asks writers for original short stories on an assigned topic. This year, the topic was neighbors. Lena Rideout reads the winning entry, Flight, by Deborah Joy Corey. Corey was born in Canada and lives in Maine. Her neighbor, an Alzheimer's sufferer, inspired this story.
Dear Mr. Miller, I'm sorry that you came into my garden. It was silly of me to think that I could steal you. You are a man after all, and they are not usually up for grabs, but it was the way you stood in my backyard, so still, and looking up to the place in that cedar tree where the cardinal had just sat not that long before, a man himself, pondering something of his life, I suppose. How long do birds live, and where do the dead ones go? Once or twice I have seen one at the mercy of a cat or dead from colliding with a window, but really, where are the rest of them? The bodies. I want to know about their bodies. I like to think that they die in flight and disintegrate before they hit the ground. That would be the best for them, wouldn't it, Mr. Miller? That would be wonderful. Nothing more than a shooting star. I had just done that whole garden thing. It was an extravagance, really. Dragging in granite rocks the size of giant turtles and then collecting moss from the woods and the smooth stones from the river shore. A garden to complement my spanking new double-wide with the step-down living room that I will always think of as our love pit, Mr. Miller. And the garden as our paradise. I bought the double wide because I never wanted to leave home again. If I absolutely had to move, I could take my home with me. I think that the whole time I was making a place for you, Mr. Miller. A place. Right here, in this dip of land, this stretch of road, the place I'd foolishly left so long ago, looking for something better. Looking for a life. For the record, Las Vegas is a pit. You stood like a slender crane looking up at the cedar tree while I stood at the kitchen window with my hands in tepid water and, dare I say, falling in love. Your thinning white hair slicked back like a movie star's, your square-rimmed black glasses. Your age, the time you had spent living, was suddenly the most alluring thing. The full life I'd always wanted. For reasons why, they ask, why did you steal Mr. Miller? And I never tell, oh no, Mr. Miller. Because even when a woman breaks the law and is in question, she keeps some things to herself. She has to. How would the world ever understand a 38-year-old divorced hairdresser stealing an 83-year-old man who had wandered away from the old folks' home? Stealing. I mean, really stealing you. They searched for days. I answered my door. And Constable Searly said you had managed to get beyond the locked gates at Milestone Manor. Had I seen you? I shook my head. No, no, I had not seen you. Yes? I would keep my eyes open. It was a neighborly thing to say. But when I touched your shoulder in the garden, you turned and commented on the raccoon couple. It was two mounds of moss, but that was exactly what I thought when I'd placed them there. I thought of them as a couple, a man and a woman. Not raccoons exactly, but maybe porcupines. Still, as you bent to touch them, I knew they were raccoons and would forever be because you had named them. You stooped so easily, almost unfolded. Instantly, I wanted to lead you inside. You followed, like my shadow, so close that I could hear your breath that I would soon learn smelled like spring rain. I did not think for one minute that senility brought you to me. Your body was your compass. You were no more ready to be alone, to be institutionalized, no more than I am now. Touching your crepey face sent my whole body asunder. Took your kissing to put it back together. After, we whispered about our lives. Lonely we had been, but for a short time we did away with that. People underestimate the power of bodies to heal. We loved each other in my sunken living room, Mr. Miller. And I will never forget what you said. You whispered that you were ready to be a shooting star. I am sorry. That is what they want me to say. Thank you for kissing me like that, Nancy.
Lena Rideout read Flight by Deborah Joy Corey, this year's Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Prize winner. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The president of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott, and the artistic director of Symphony Space is Laura Kaminsky. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs, presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, are recorded by Phil Richards. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2010 by Richard Russo. Additional support has been provided by Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is also supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and public radio international stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.